The eyes have it on this week's Please Explain segment. We're going to talk about how our eyes work, eye health, and the diseases and conditions of the eye that affect our vision with Dr. George A. Chaffee, Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology and Ophthalmologist-in-Chief at the Department of Ophthalmology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Chaffee is an expert in glaucoma and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Glaucoma. We invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Dr. Chaffee, what are the main component parts of the human eye? What do we need to know to understand how our eyes work?
Probably the simplest analogy is the camera analogy, and that is we have some focusing mechanisms on the front, sort of like the lenses on a camera. The back of the eye, the retina, is more like the film in the camera that takes the image that's focused with the lens and cornea on the front of the eye. And then the optic nerve, which is the neural connection or transmission cable, sends that image back to our brain, and our brain interprets the electrical signal as sight. Pretty complex system, actually, and it's estimated that about 50% of the brain is actually involved with eyesight, eye movements, and monitoring what's going on in the eye.
Now, for dogs, much of the brain is involved with the nose. So are our eyes doing the kind of thing in dealing with the rest of the world that a dog's nose does for it?
Well, sure. I guess sampling the environment is really what all of our senses are about, whether it be touch or smell or seeing. And so we're trying to take in the maximal input, and it informs us about dangers. It informs us about good things as well. And so it's a nice analogy to talk about a dog's nose and our eyes.
I've heard the eye described as an external aspect of the brain. What does that mean?
Well, it really is the only place on the body where we can look in. We can examine the eye, and we can actually see the extension of the brain. The optic nerve and the retina are direct extensions of the front of the brain, if you will, and direct connections to it. It's the only place where you can really see blood vessels, both arteries and veins. You can detect the relative health of people often just by looking in the back of the eyes and doing a dilated examination.
How can you do that? I mean, what relative health are we talking about? Diabetes, I understand, but anything else?
Well, sure, actually, and it's sort of apropos that we're talking today because May is the NIH's Healthy Vision Month each year, and there's a big push to get people to have eye exams, especially those over the age of 40. You know, oftentimes we get examined as a child when we're school age and maybe get glasses along the way, but then we neglect follow-up for some years. So the NIH's push to get a dilated eye exam, a complete eye exam by an eye care professional. And when we look in the back of the eye, we can see things like atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries. We can see plaques and stuff that otherwise would need special imaging or special testing elsewhere in the body. Hypertension, high blood pressure can be detected often in the back of the eye by changes in the arteries and veins. As you said, diabetes. And certainly if you have diabetes or suspected of having diabetes, regular eye examinations every 6 to 12 months are imperative to ongoing health and ongoing vision.
Now, when I think of the eyes, I think of them as receptors, but it's a two-way street, isn't it? Our eyes seem to know how to move, and rather quickly. We just look at something, lenses focus, information pours into our brain. How does the eye get the message to look and then see?
It's amazing how quickly it all happens, isn't it? So if we go back to that camera analogy, it's not just one camera, it's two cameras that have to move in perfect synchrony. And so that's why so much of the brain actually is taken up in both the receiving, as you said, and the controlling of the eyes. So there's six tiny muscles that control the movements of the eye, and it has to do it in a yoke-like fashion where both eyes are moving simultaneously to keep an image, the image of interest, in the center of the retina, the macula. And so it is a complex system, and it is a two-way street. And you can see that, you know, that if you shine a bright light in somebody's eyes, their pupils constrict. And that takes the message going back to the brain and then coming back to the eye and the muscles in the iris to constrict the pupil. So it is, it goes back and forth many times a second between the receiving end and the output.
What does the placement of our eyes in our head mean for our vision? Obviously, we can determine three-dimensionality, but is that simply it?
Well, so, you know, we actually have forward-seeing eyes. Some animals, as you know, have eyes that are independent on the side of their heads, like birds often times do. Their eyes don't work together, so they don't have the same three-dimensional or the ability to have stereoscopic vision that we have. That gives us an ability to do fine work up close, to pour our cream and our coffee, to thread a needle because of the binocular placement. However, some animals have adapted because they need to see more of the landscape around them to evade predators, so they have the eyes on the side of their head where they have a much wider field of view than we have.
We do have peripheral vision, and I've heard that we actually see peripherally in black and white, and then our brain adjusts. Is that true?
Well, so the majority of peripheral vision is supplied to us by our more peripheral retina in the back of the eye. The retina lines the entire inside of the back of the eye. And out in the periphery, there are rods as opposed to cones. Cones are the light and color-sensing cells in the back of our eyes, and they're really more so in the middle, the macular region of the eye, and they give us the color vision. Out in the periphery are more cones, so you're right. In a sense, we do have more black and white vision out in the periphery, and then our brain corrects for that.
Now, we hear that normal vision is 20/20. That is not the best vision, is it?
Well, some people are better than 20/20. 20/20 is just our way of denoting that you see at 20 feet what a normal or average eye sees at 20 feet. Some people are better, and you'll see it written down as 20/15 or 20/10. Often athletes and people that have huge vision demands, turns out that they have excellent vision, better than some of the rest of us.
My guest is Dr. George A. Chaffee, Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology and Ophthalmologist-in-Chief at the Department of Ophthalmology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. We're talking about eyes on today's Please Explain. Are there any differences between the eyes of men and women or between people of different races?
Actually, very little. There's some susceptibility differences amongst different populations to certain diseases, just as there are with other diseases of the body. Very little difference, actually, between men's vision and women's vision. We do see as people age that there's some differences in all sorts of medical problems between groups, though.
What about newborns? What are they seeing, and how soon do they start seeing what we would see?
It actually takes weeks to months for them to start processing a clear image. So oftentimes when that two-week-old baby smiles at you, it probably is gas, not that they like you that much. But they develop over time, and that process actually continues to go on even into their later school years. And it's not until the age of 8, 10, or even 12 years old where the visual system is completely developed.
Really? As late as 8 or 10? Wow. What about floaters? Why do they appear? And do they tend to be more prevalent in nearsighted people?
They are. And actually, the back of the eye in front of the retina is filled with a viscous-like material called vitreous. And this material becomes more and more liquid as we age. And it also gains small opacities within it. And so floaters are actually a shadow of the opacity. It casts a shadow onto the retina. And so we see the floater actually, in fact, floating through the vitreous. As we get a bit older, into our 60s, 70s, and 80s, the vitreous is so liquid that the floaters oftentimes get out of the way. They oftentimes, through gravity, just settle out.
Now, what causes nearsightedness and farsightedness? Is it genetic, or is it true that kids who read a lot are more likely to become nearsighted, and kids who spend a lot of time outdoors are more likely to become farsighted?
Great debate right now, and it's probably a combination of environmental factors driving certain predispositions that are genetic towards nearsightedness. If you look at some countries that schoolwork is pushed more so than other countries, you'll see that inside reading under incandescent lights actually increases the chance of being nearsighted, or myopic. Myopia is the term for nearsightedness, whereas other populations that are more outside do in fact have more farsighted. That is been seen over and over. Actually, probably the highest prevalence of nearsighted people are in Singapore. And there's an evolving literature right now looking at this, and now we suspect that actually there's probably some genetic predisposition to nearsightedness. A nearsighted eye is typically longer than a farsighted eye, which tends to be shorter. The term for farsightedness is hyperopia. And the longer, what generates the longer eye to grow longer, probably has both environmental factors, but probably a genetic predisposition.
And what about astigmatism?
Astigmatism is when the front of the eye is not quite spherical, typically caused mainly by the cornea. Astigmatism can happen and can develop at any age, but probably is driven in a much different way than myopia or hyperopia.
And because the eye is not perfectly rounded, I guess, that causes distortion in our vision?
It is. So if the cornea, which is the front window in the eye, just in front of the iris is the blue, brown, green part of our eye, if the cornea isn't quite spherical, isn't quite symmetric, then you'll have aberrations in how the light is focused in the back of the eye. So we correct that with glasses. We essentially provide in lenses the opposite correction to make up for the aberrations in the cornea.
Can it also be corrected with LASIK surgery?
It can. It can be corrected with LASIK surgery, where we remodel the cornea. And over the last couple decades, there's been great advances in correction at the time of cataract surgery, where instead of putting it in a pair of glasses or remodeling the cornea, when we take out a cataract, the cloudy lens inside the eye, we can replace it with a so-called toric lens, which corrects for the astigmatism. So it's sort of like having a built-in astigmatism correction that you would normally have in your glasses, you now have in the lens that's implanted into your eye.
We've got to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the major problems of the eyes, glaucoma, macular degeneration, what diabetes does, et cetera. And we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Or also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guest is Dr. George A. Chiaffi, Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology and Ophthalmologist-in-Chief of the Department of Ophthalmology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. ¶¶ We are back with Dr. George A. Chiaffi, Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology and Ophthalmologist in Chief of the Department of Ophthalmology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. And we are talking about eyes on today's Please Explain, inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's take a call from Richard from Queens. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. Doctor, I was wondering if the use of glasses to correct vision, and perhaps glasses which make the image much more distinct than the eye would normally be able to have, serves to some extent to weaken the muscles of the eye to adjust on their own without glasses.
So the correction of the image, especially early on when we're children, is terribly important to the development of the eye. So you've probably heard the term lazy eye. Oftentimes it's not that the eye is lazy, it's just that it hasn't received a clear image, and so it doesn't go on to develop correctly.
Is that different than cross-eyed?
Well, it can lead to cross-eyed. If the image doesn't develop correctly, then one eye may be ignored and may drift in or out, and so they're all connected. So that what I talked about earlier, where a child's eye doesn't finish developing until the age of 8 to 10 years old, it needs a clear image early on. Later in life, there's really no evidence to show that wearing corrective glasses somehow weakens your ability to see. It provides you with a clear image. It's simply making up for the optical aberrations or the imperfections of the front of the eye to give you a correct image back onto the retina to take that snapshot to send back to your brain.
Thank you for your call. We go now to Christine from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have everything you've talked about. I have had a detached retina, cataract surgeries. I may have glaucoma now. I had strabismus eye turn surgery, and my eye, I've been told, is longer than anything my doctors had ever seen. Long meaning the most myopic, I think. So much so that when they took measurements on it to do the cataract surgery, they didn't do it because they couldn't believe the readings they got. Now, over time, my retina on the other eye that didn't detach is wearing away, and meaning that it didn't detach, it's just it looks like I'm looking through gauze and so forth. So I have two questions. One is, no one ever talks about nutrition or vitamins or anything like that. So, and I've asked every doctor. And the other is, the trauma of losing my vision is something that I can't even begin to put into words, but it's as if one day I got a finger cut off and I have to learn to work with just four fingers, and then I do it. And then the next time I lose another patch of vision, I go through this terrible physical, emotional trauma, and nobody seems to be able to lead me in the direction of a doctor or a therapist to deal with the emotional anxieties that, because you can walk with a limp, but you can always sit down. You can't not look through your eyes. It's very difficult to ignore.
Thank you for your call, Christine. Most people, I guess, fear losing their eyesight if they have eyesight. On the other hand, there are people who are born without eyesight, and they adjust to the world.
In virtually every poll out there, losing one's eyesight is right at the top of the list, or second perhaps to losing one's life in terms of the fears that we all have. Because as we talked about earlier, eyesight informs us so much about our environment and allows us to enjoy and to get through our days so effectively. So the fear of losing eyesight that Christine talked about is anxiety producing. There are actually very good resources in the New York area. It's part of the benefit of living in the greatest city in the world. For such, there are the Jewish Guild for the Blind, which is now the Guild, Lighthouse Guild International, where the Lighthouse and the Jewish Guild have joined their forces. They're a wonderful resource in terms of occupational therapists, physical therapists, and counselors in dealing with vision loss and getting on with your life, even if you do have limited vision. So vision rehabilitation specialists are throughout the New York area, and I'd urge you to reach out to them.
Now, there were a number of questions she asked. Can nutrition be a factor? Should we be eating a lot of carrots, as our mother suggested?
Well, Mom was probably right. She might have had which vitamins wrong, but there has been a very large study, one of the largest studies ever done by the NIH, called the Age-Related Eye Disease Study, and you'll see the abbreviation AREDS, A-R-E-D-S. The AREDS study took 6,000 people with some changes in the back of their eye that might have predisposed them to macular degeneration, and it gave a certain vitamin formula to half and not to the other half. And it did show a marginal but real effect, a significant effect in terms of preventing macular degeneration. And so there is probably good sense in terms of vitamin health. We don't know it for everything else, but it makes sense that what's healthy for your body, exercise, eating well, vitamin therapy is probably healthy for your eyes.
I'm talking with Dr. George A. Chiaffi, Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology and Ophthalmologist-in-Chief of the Department of Ophthalmology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We are doing one of our Please Explain segments, this time devoted to eyes. I'm Leonard Lopate. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. The caller said she had a detached retina. What causes a detached retina?
So people that have myopia, as we talked about earlier, have a longer than normal eye, and the retina lines inside of the eye. So if the eye is elongated, the retina is put on stretch, and it can actually detach from the inside of the eye. If it detaches, depending on how long and how extensive a detachment, it can cause a permanent vision loss. The retina gets most of its blood supply from the layers underneath of it, and so when it detaches from that blood supply, it can die off.
Now, doesn't that long eye also cause glaucoma because the pressure that it causes on the optic nerves breaks optic nerves?
So glaucoma is actually a family of diseases. There's about 40 types of glaucoma, all unified by the fact that they damage the optic nerve, as you said, which is that neural connection between our eye and our brain. Sometimes there is elevated intraocular pressure. There can be an association with nearsightedness or myopia, but sometimes not. There's certainly a familial predilection to glaucoma, so if you have a relative, a first-degree relative with glaucoma, you should absolutely be seen. There's also populations that are more prone to glaucoma. We know that African Americans are some 4 to 6 times more likely to have glaucoma than Caucasian Americans. So it is important. It's part of the initiative of the NIH to get a dilated exam, get looked at, have not only the health of your retina, but the health of your optic nerve assessed.
Well, when people have glaucoma, they take eye drops that reduce the pressure in the eye, don't they? That's to prevent it from pressing against the optic nerves, which are tiny little fibers?
Exactly. So there's the optic nerve itself is made up of about 1 million to 1.5 million tiny fibers in our eyes, and all those fibers take the information back to our brain. When there is elevated pressure in many forms of glaucoma, we do lower the pressure, and we can lower it with medications, both oral and drops. We can also lower it with some laser therapies. And in a small segment of glaucoma populations, about 10 to 15%, there's actually surgical procedures that are available to lower the pressure.
Fred asks on Twitter, what is exfoliation? How does it affect the eye, especially in regard to someone with glaucoma and cataracts?
Yeah, that's a great question. Exfoliation syndrome is a syndrome that was described many decades ago. And it's a protein that's deposited inside the front of the eye. It's actually found all over the body. It's been found in heart muscle. It's been found in skin. It's been found in kidneys. But the only thing that we know that it does is actually cause a particularly difficult type of cataract to take out and cause glaucoma. Actually, in some populations, like in Scandinavian countries, it's the number one cause of glaucoma. In the U.S., it makes up about 20% of glaucomas. We don't know why it occurs, and we don't know why it only causes problems in the eyes when this protein is deposited all over the body. But it is a very treatable form of glaucoma. It is something that we like to know about because it can make cataract surgery much more difficult. And so if you have pseudo-exfoliation or exfoliation syndrome, it's good to know ahead of time, and you need to be watched closely for the possible development of cataracts and glaucoma.
A listener wonders what causes color blindness.
Well, there's several forms of color blindness, but almost all of them are genetically passed on. Men are much more likely to be colorblind and have certain forms of color blindness as opposed to women because of where it's carried in the genetic code. But genetics is the answer to most forms of color blindness.
Let's take another call. This one is from Donald from Vernon, New Jersey. Hi, Donald. You're on the air. Oh,
good afternoon. Can you address the effects of, besides on glaucoma, marijuana on vision? I kind of have personal experience. I'm 62, and I've got 20/25 vision. And I used to have to wear glasses when I was younger. Then I started using marijuana, and I don't need to wear glasses.
So
has research been done into that?
Yeah, as you can imagine, we're getting more and more questions about marijuana, and as the caller hinted at, most of them revolve around glaucoma. We do know that marijuana intake, either eating or smoking, will lower the pressure in the eye, so it's been touted as a potential therapy for glaucoma. When that is taken, the problem is that we haven't been able to separate the psychotropic effects of marijuana from the eye pressure lowering effects. And certainly if it's being smoked, the ill effects of smoking far outweigh the potential beneficial effects. So as a glaucoma therapy to date, it hasn't really taken shape, although there's a lot of research in terms of the cannabinoids, which are the active ingredient of marijuana and the eyes. Also the brain, too, because there may be some neuronal or neural perfective effects as well. In terms of the vision getting better with our caller as he began intaking marijuana, could be by chance. I don't have a good answer for why his vision got better, but I suspect I'm not going to talk him out of his present course.
A number of listeners are wondering about the effect of looking at computers all day and iPhones and computer games on eyes. Are we seeing an impact?
It probably gets back to that discussion about whether or not nearsightedness or myopia is genetically determined or environmentally. It is suspected that all the close work we're doing may, in fact, drive the development of nearsightedness in folks. Certainly with computer monitors and anything, including just reading a book, we blink less, we stare more, we don't lubricate the front of our eyes with our tears as much because we're not blinking as much. So the tiredness that we all experience with any prolonged visual effort is certainly true with these near devices, our cell phones, our computer games, and our computer monitors.
Jenny wonders on our show page why so many people develop farsightedness as they get older.
Yeah, so Actually, in most people, there's a shift towards nearsightedness in the majority of people, so-called second sight, where people, as a cataract develops, as a cataract is a cloudy lens inside the eye, but one of the first changes of the lens is that it gets a little bigger, so it becomes more of a magnifying lens, meaning that we then see better up close. And so that happens often in our 50s and 60s, and so many people will actually see better up close. In terms of the farsightedness, when we're younger, we can actually change the shape of our lens inside our eye, and that's why we can read up close and then look in the distance. We lose that ability as we get older, and farsighted people actually lose that ability earlier, maybe in their late 30s or even early 40s, whereas nearsighted people lose it later on. So people that are farsighted start noticing these changes earlier on because they can't change the shape of the lens anymore to focus up close.
And that's why they wind up buying those reading glasses at the local pharmacy.
Exactly. Once our arms get too short for us to hold the book way out far, we have to start using reading help.
What's involved with corneal transplants? Do they restore vision?
You know, corneal transplantation is one of the great success stories of the last 100 years, and that is the ability to take a cloudy cornea, the front window in the eye, and replace it with a donor cornea from a cadaver or eye banks. The eye bank system in the U.S. Has been incredibly successful. Because the cornea has very few, if any, blood vessels, it's what we call a privileged tissue, so we don't need to match it as closely as we do for a kidney transplant. And so corneal transplantation really has been a miracle for many, and it does clear up a scarred cornea from an infection or trauma. In the last decade to 15 years, a new corneal transplantation technique has been developed where we just transplant the back half of the cornea. This has a great benefit in that the healing is so much quicker. The surgery is actually much more effective, and people, instead of regaining their vision in weeks to months, often are regaining it in days to week. So corneal transplantation really is something that wasn't even dreamed of 100 years ago, and now is commonplace.
Dr. Chaffee, you've been a great guest. I thank you so much for being on our show today. Dr. George A. Chaffee, Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology and Ophthalmologist-in-Chief of the Department of Ophthalmology at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. All mine. Thank you.